This is a Sound Rebel podcast.
To work with us on your podcast, go to soundrebel.co.uk. Over the Influence is no longer just a podcast. Our online community is buzzing with people like you.
My name's Nicole and I'm from Brisbane in Australia. I was sick and tired of feeling sick and tired and had just begun yet another attempt at a non-drinking stint when I discovered the Over the Influence podcasts. The timing couldn't have been better. I binge listened to them all, joined the OTI community and have never looked back. If, like me, you've tried and tried to put down the plonk, but even after some success, keep finding yourself pulled back into the mire, join us in the OTI community, where we all share our stories of what works and what doesn't and where we're currently at. Everyone's just so full of understanding and inspiration. In a few weeks, I'll reach a whole year without a single drop, and I can't thank the OTI community enough. You guys rock and make all the difference in the booze-free world.
You've heard the podcast. Now join the conversation. Go to overtheinfluence.co.uk.
Welcome to Over the Influence. It's December. It's festive. We're feeling good and we're feeling festive. AF. Translate that however you wish. It's got two meanings, hasn't it? Alcohol free and anyway, can't say that word because it's sweary. Like I said, welcome to the podcast. An introduction as to who we are. My name is Sharon Hartley. Everybody calls me Shaz. Based in Lancashire in the northwest of England. I think this will be my sixth alcohol-free Christmas. I'm more than 5 years sober now, made a massive change, just approaching my 45th birthday, just celebrated my 50th sober, and it was brilliant. And Christmases alcohol-free can also be brilliant. At first, they're a little bit different. Yes, they are. However, you can get through it, and most importantly, you can enjoy it. So many people say to me, Shaz, how bad did it get? What was your rock bottom? How much did you use to drink? I don't really answer those questions anymore because you don't need a rock bottom and you certainly don't need to know how much I drank. I drank too much, too quickly and too often. Decided to take a break. I'm still doing it now. Hands down, it's the best thing I ever flipping did. Cannot wait to get into this week's episode with our guest. I'll introduce him to you very, very shortly. We've been trying for weeks, been trying for months, but he's just too busy being alcohol-free and fabulous. Before you hear from our guest today, Ben Anderson, how the hell are you? Feeling festive?
Yes, 2 weeks today until Christmas, Sharon.
OMG!
If you're listening to this on the day of release, that means 2 weeks until our Christmas special with Ruth Jones.
I didn't know we were saying that today. Is that out there now?
Yeah, no, it's been out there for
a while.
I've been telling people for ages, so I don't know. Sorry, if I was supposed to keep it a secret, I haven't been.
Not anymore.
Yeah, 2 weeks. Ruth Jones, Christmas Day will be out 6 a.m. UK time. Make sure you download it. I mean, I know that Christmas Day is busy, but you get to spend it with me, Shaz, and Ruth Jones for at least just an hour. Anyway, I'm Ben. I'm 35. I live in Liverpool. This will be my fifth alcohol-free Christmas. And we've just been talking, Shaz, about how fabulous it is to be alcohol-free at Christmas. Because isn't it lovely to remember December? There's so many great things in this month. Like, I've already been to a Santa sing-along. I've been to a carol service. I've seen the Coca-Cola truck. Like, we're in full swing here at the Andersons. And honestly, I used to spend Decembers just feeling crap all the way through. I'd launch December with a huge night out, followed by another big one. And I'd just take every opportunity to drink in December, every single opportunity. And I'd use all my energy on just trying to feel average. Like, I wouldn't spend my energy trying, like, enjoying everything and, like, really throwing myself into everything because December is great. I just felt rubbish. I just felt rubbish and crap. And by the time the actual Christmas Day came along, oh, God, I've got to spend all day being sociable. Oh, I just want to be in bed. So glad that this is my fifth alcohol-free Christmas. Shaz, before we get to our guest, can I read you a quote?
Because please do. It's been at least 10 minutes since we've had one.
I think this really applies to our guest today. So this is from the Disney CEO, Bob Iger. If you're in the business of making something, be in the business of making something great. And I think that's exactly what our guest is currently doing and spending a lot of time and energy on. Go on, you do the big intro.
I already know that he's right up our street, and I just sort of knew straight away when I saw all his stuff on socials. It gives us great pleasure today to welcome Carl Considine, who lives in Manchester. Crikey, Carl, you're a busy fella. You're impossible to pin down. Thank God we finally got you. How are you?
Oh, my God. I don't know if I can live up to this introduction. And actually, I don't know if I just want to sit here and talk or if I want to listen to you two have this conversation and make all of these funny jokes. I've just been sat here like, these two are hilarious. I'll just sit and listen in.
Well, you're more than welcome. But I mean, it would be quite helpful as our guest if you want to contribute over the next hour or so. That'd be quite good.
I've got to have some
really
worth
would.
In this conversation, right? Thank you
Absolutely.
For the warm welcome. I'm so excited to get festive AF with the pair of you. There's a lot to talk about. And God, Ben, what you were just saying about Christmas, and you get to Christmas Day when you're drinking and you've just had enough, haven't you? And you're just doing it to feel better, to deal with family, to do whatever. And Christ, it's such a life hack. It's such a dream to experience Christmas sober and to remember it. Yeah, remember December. I love that little pun.
If I'm being completely honest, it was easily a decade, probably longer, that I'd start every Christmas Day either, this is so gross, but either being sick or feeling sick. Like, because we'd have a massive night out. It was like our school lad tradition. We'd all get back together, you know, go to uni, different parts of the country, some cases different parts of the world. We'd all come back to mum and dad's for Christmas. And Christmas Eve was one of the biggest nights out of the year. Yeah. And so I'd start every Christmas Day feeling dreadful.
Yeah.
For years. Why do we do it to ourselves, Carl?
I don't know. It's crazy. And I think, like, so I've just opened an alcohol-free bar, and like the timing's a bit odd because Christmas is pretty boozy, right? And people like a drink and Christmas markets and all of that. And, you know, I get it. But also it's like, hang on a minute. You don't have to drink every day throughout December. There are different things to do. And not to be judgmental or preachy, you know, I'm pro-choice and do what you want to do and do what works for you. But there is an alternative. And trust me, it's so much more fun because you don't feel like shit. And you remember everything that's actually happening and make proper connections with people.
Oh, we've got so much to talk about, Carl. We really
there's
have.
There's a lot on. There's a lot on.
There's a lot on, isn't there? There really is. Before we were chatting to you tonight, myself and Ben were recording our premium podcast, and we were talking about the fact that during December in particular, everything is ramped up. You know, your social life is ramped up. The pressure to drink is ramped up. And, you know, if you want to get a brew from one of these, like, little, I don't know, converted flipping horse shacks or whatever they are, it's either got brandy in it or it's got Baileys in it. And it's everything's mulled within a 20-mile radius. And it's like, oh, my God. The pressure is immense. But to use a term that Ben uses a lot on the podcast and within the community, once you unplug yourself from the matrix and you give yourself a bit of a breather and a bit of a break. I love the fact that you called it, Carl, a life hack. Christmas and December can be done beautifully and, most importantly, enjoyably, and a lot of fun, can't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm approaching my third Christmas. And honestly, approaching Christmas number one, like you said, I think at the start, Shaz, it's tricky, isn't it? Because, you know,
it's so different.
It's just so different. And I was very much in like self-pity and woe is me, you know, oh, my life is over. What am I going to do? Holidays are going to be boring. Birthdays are going to be boring. Christmas is going to be boring. What on earth am I going to do if I'm not getting drunk every day? And if I'm not starting Christmas morning, either being sick or being sick and then having some Bucks Fizz to make myself feel better with my bacon butty, like, what do you do? But now I can see on the other side of that, having got through two Christmases, that it's just so much better. And for me, it's so much better to just feel fresh and to just have a nice time without having to get wasted, basically.
We could talk about Christmas in December for the entire episode, but before we get more into that, and I want to talk about your alcohol-free bar and Love Sober and everything else that you've got going on, you mentioned, Carl, that you're approaching now 3 years sober. Do you mind just rewinding, taking us back and telling us a bit about you before you made the change in your life?
Yeah, of course. Let's go back. So I got sober on the 4th of Jan 2021. So I'm about a month off 3 years at the moment. Woohoo! And I genuinely never thought that I would say that, you know, because I did hit rock bottom. And my rock bottom was a very dark place. It was a place where I didn't see like life in the too distant future, because I just had enough. I was over life. I was over the responsibility that I felt living required. It felt like such a difficult trade-off for me to get through day to day. I always struggled with day to day life and responsibility and expectation. And what I found in drink was the ability to be able to just numb those feelings and to block a lot of that out. But obviously what comes hand in hand with that are all the negative consequences of heavy drinking. So I would describe myself as an alcoholic, and I would describe myself as being in recovery. That language works for me. I know it doesn't work for everyone, but I find it quite helpful. The last year or so of my drinking had gone from me being, I always thought I was a social drinker. For years, my excuse was, I love a party. I just love going out and getting pissed with my mates and, you know, after work wine and Prosecco and going clubbing on the weekend. And I've always lived in a city centre, so I have always been a really social person. But the last few years of my drinking weren't social. It was me drinking alone by myself in my apartment, literally with my curtains drawn in the dark. And that's when you know it's a problem, right? And people had been telling me it's a problem for years, but I wasn't ready to hear that. And I wasn't ready to admit that, even though I could see that life was falling apart around me. My mental health was in the pits. My physical health was horrendous. I had lost like any meaningful connection in my life. I was estranged from my family. Most of my friends had stepped away, and, you know, some of my best friends had said things to me like, I can't watch yourself kill yourself, and I can't stick around whilst you're continuing to do what you do, because I was a daily drinker in the end. And I'd get up in the morning and I'd go to the co-op over the road, and, you know, I'd be buying my wine and my cigarettes for the day. And I can look back on some of this stuff now and laugh. And I know that sounds crazy given what I've just said, but I still had like so much ego attached to the way that I was living and the perception that I wanted to put out there. So I'd be going to the co-op opposite where I lived at 7 in the morning, literally waiting for the co-op to open. And I thought that if I bought expensive bottles of red wine and really over-explained this to the person that was on the cash desk, that I wouldn't deem to be someone that was an alcoholic or was a problem drinker. Or, you know, I was that hyper aware of these things. And often I'd find myself saying things like, oh yeah, I've got a dinner party tonight. I'll have a couple of bottles of the Bordeaux and, you know, all this type of crap. And I was in debt up to my eyeballs. I couldn't afford to buy bottles of Bordeaux. But I was doing a lot of this stuff to keep up appearances with a shop, like someone who works in a shop that has got no interest in my life, really. But that's how much psychologically it mattered to me to try and cover up what I was doing, even though people were really clear in what was happening and people were telling me that what they were seeing was a problem. So yeah, it got to the point where I was referred into services, and essentially I had some blood tests done because I was pretty unwell physically, and an alcohol nurse said to me, if you keep drinking the way that you're drinking, your parents are going to be coming to your funeral in the next few years. And yeah, it was a really conflicting feeling, because in my heavy drinking I used to fantasize about falling asleep and not waking up. That's what I would want to happen. But then somebody saying to me, well, actually, if you keep drinking at this rate, that is what's going to happen sometime soon. It was the first time I'd realized that wasn't the outcome that I wanted, and that I was really terrified of that outcome. And I did want something better. You know, people say the gift of desperation, don't they? And that was my first kind of introduction to desperation and hope, I guess. And so from there, I was referred into services and I went into treatment. So I did outpatient treatment, which is quite tricky because you go in the day and then you have to go home at night. But you get tested every morning when you go back in. And, you know, if you've got anything that comes up in your urine test, then you get kicked off the program, basically. And as a classic all or nothing type person, as soon as I got into treatment, for me, the focus was like, all I have to do this because I can't continue to live in this way and put myself through this. I went all in, and I'm pleased to say that treatment sorted me out, and I've managed to maintain my sobriety. And I think it's also important to say, you know, I think sometimes there is a perception that recovery, when you use language like recovery, that it's a daily battle and I'm constantly fighting the urge to drink. And maybe that is the case for some people, but actually close to 3 years, that is not the case for me. I have zero desire to drink. My mindset has completely changed. Like, I couldn't think of anything worse, and I don't experience cravings anymore. You know, my life is completely turned around, and I never thought that I could achieve that. Sorry, I feel like I've just given you my backstory in like quite a long-winded way, but
no, it's fabulous. It's great to hear. And we've got members, we've got people watching this Zoom call who are members, fabulous members of our community, and people saying, you know, this is my story, totally resonate. Carl, taking you back, what did you feel as if daily life expected from you? I think that's a really interesting choice of words.
Yeah, I've always had this sense of responsibility and really struggling with adulthood. And it can be, there isn't like a really, the answer's quite simple. So I used to struggle with day-to-day tasks, cleaning, going to the supermarket, running out of things that I needed to buy, like looking after myself, brushing my teeth. I know this sounds like so simplistic because they're quite like basic human needs, right? But I used to really struggle with it. And then like throw having a job in the mix and a social life and meeting the expectations of a family member or a partner, it would send me west. I just couldn't cope with it. I couldn't handle it. And I think it comes from, I went through a lot of trauma in childhood, and my mum is an addict, and I had to parent my two younger siblings from the age of about 9. And so I've always grown up with this sense of responsibility that I think then in adult life, I never had like emotional maturing, and as a result, just struggled with day-to-day living. And I've had to like do a lot of unlearning and relearning in sobriety. And it's taken me a long time to get on top of those things. And a little kind of mantra that I have now is, what does little Carl need? And it's something that my therapist helped me with. But if I'm struggling with something that is a daily task or like just looking after myself, it's okay, this is where I've got this fear and where I'm struggling. That's actually little Carl that's struggling. And so I have to think to myself, right, okay, what does little Carl need? Just parent yourself, like cook a proper meal, go out for a walk, give someone a call. Because irrespective of whether alcohol is in my life or not, I still struggle with things, right? You know, life is not all plain sailing. And as much as sobriety is incredible, existing is also tricky sometimes.
Wow. It's just phenomenal to hear where you were and where you've come from, and then talking there about little Carl as well, to where you are today with your own sobriety podcast and alcohol-free bars and everything. It's almost like two different people, but it's not. It was always you. It's phenomenal. It's breathtaking.
It is like two different people, and sometimes I find myself referring to myself as like, or old Carl, or, you know, new Carl kind of thing, because a few things have happened in this transition. My friendship group's completely different. And, you know, I've got a few friends that have stuck around that are like lifers, but I also lost a lot of friends. But equally, I made some decisions about people I was friends with based on what they brought into my life, which I realized in early sobriety was I had a lot of acquaintances, not friends. I had a lot of people I could ring if I wanted to go out and get wasted. And those were like-minded people that typically I met in bars, probably in the smoking area outside, talking absolute shite to someone, giving them my life story and then becoming best mates because I knew I'd be able to repeat that behavior with them week after week after week. And I went through a period of isolation in early sobriety because like a lot of those dynamics changed and a lot of those relationships changed. But yeah, it's like two different people. And when I talk about the alcohol-free bar, I was chatting to my key worker recently, the person that got me into treatment, and they were like, oh, do you want to come to our Christmas party and do some like alcohol-free drinks for us? And I'm like, this is wild. Like, I'm an addict and you guys like got me sober. And now you're like, oh, do you want to come in and do some drinks and like talk about the podcast? And so, yeah, I still feel that, Chaz.
It's wonderful. It's amazing. It's so inspiring. And there'll be somebody listening to this and you are giving people hope. And I just want to take you back to what you were talking about a little bit earlier on about that moment where you realised that actually... Mm-hmm. You did want to wake up from a deep sleep. Mm. Where did that little nugget of hope come from?
Do you know, with alcohol, you numb a lot and you mask a lot, right? And I actually think the hope was there all along, but it wasn't able to get through because I was numbing any kind of emotion. I didn't just want to block out negative emotion. I wanted to block out all emotion. I didn't want to feel anything. And so even if hope was trying to get through, I was never going to feel it. And in that moment, when it was during COVID, when I got that call, so I wasn't able to do the appointment in person, the nurse had to ring me, and I was sat in my lounge and the curtains were drawn and my apartment stunk of cigarette smoke because I'd been sat drinking and smoking inside. And it was really illuminating because as she was saying the words, and I was just looking around my apartment, and it was like I could see, like I had my eyes open to what my life was actually like for the first time. And yeah, something got through, that glimmer of hope got through. And you know, some might say, no, I wouldn't say it was like an intervention. Like, I'm a spiritual person and, you know, there's something happening up there in the universe, but I don't believe in a divine being that's giving me direction. I just think, yeah, it finally, that little bit of fight that was in there came through and gave me the opportunity to see like a way out, basically.
Carl, I'm going to do something now that it will make me feel uncomfortable.
Oh, no.
But I think, in this example, I think it's important that we juxtapose old Carl and new Carl. What I mean is we're coming out of the chronological order of your story here, because I think, you know, the guy who did find it difficult to do, as you said, kind of the normal daily tasks that you do, to the guy now who, as we said at the beginning, very busy man with lots going on.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about life now? Like, what does a week look like for you with all the different things that you got going on?
Oh my God, it's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. I'm such a cliche. Like, I run, I go to the gym, I go to spin, I go to yoga, breath work, wild swimming, cold water dips. Like, yeah, I fulfill the like.
I'm such a cliche.
Oh, come on.
Honest
walking
God.
Cliche, Carl.
I know, it's sickening. It's sickening. And at first it was, I got really into like fitness because it made me feel different. So, you know, that's what you're always searching for, right? But over the years, I've had lots of therapy and, you know, I've been able to fix to a degree that hole in my soul, but also figure out what I like and what I'm into. Because again, in early sobriety, you go through a bit of an identity crisis, or I did. I was like, my God, like people talk about the gift of time. I don't want all this time because I've got nothing to do. Like, what the hell do I do with all this additional time that I've got on my hands? And so I started running, just going out for a little jog here and there. And now I run every single day. I've got a PT. I lift weights. I go to spin classes. Yeah, all of the things I just said, you know, anything that is, it's almost like I've spent, I think somewhere in my subconscious, I've spent such a long time abusing my body. Now I'm in this headspace of, I'm going to like look after the shit of myself. Like I'm going to make sure that I get the best care and that I'm in the best shape, not just because it feels good, but also conversely to what I was saying earlier, I want to live as long as possible. And, you know, I've got goals and dreams for the future. So yeah, I start every day with exercise. I'm also one of these annoying idiots that wakes up at 5 a.m. to start the day.
I knew it. I just knew it, Carl. I could tell.
But you don't say things like, oh yeah, I'm part of the 5 a.m. club.
No.
You don't go that far.
I hate the 5 a.m. club, like hustle culture. Like,
I bet you journal as well, don't you, when you get up?
I journal.
I knew it.
I meditate for 10 minutes. I do some exercise. I have like my overnight oats or like a little protein smoothie or whatever it is. But Shaz, it's because I never used to see the mornings. And now I'm like, do you know what? Yeah. I want to make the most of mornings. Like, and not to sound like a bloody, it's almost like Sound of Music here that I'm visualizing in my mind. But, you know, I love the sound of the birds tweeting in the morning.
Oh, my God. I can't believe you've said that.
I love it.
Carl, people think I am crazy, right? So we host Zoom calls within the community. Ben, don't give me that look, because he does. The amount of times, Carl, that I have said one of my most favourite sounds in the world, and it stems from early sobriety, is the sound of the birds. I can even name you a bird, and it was the oyster catchers on Morecambe Prom when I used to go for my early morning walks when I first started doing this nonsense. And even now, I will hear the bird song. I go out and feed them. I'm like bloody Dr. Doolittle or whoever
it
is.
I love it.
Carl, I knew we'd get on, and this is why. This is why.
Come on, she says, I call her up and she says things like, oh, I've had a great, great day so far. I heard a blue-titted sparrow in garden and it just set me up right.
I bought a bird feeding station, Carl.
Oh, God.
That's where I'm at.
I saw a funny meme about this the other day, like about recovery. And it's like you go from like your focus being booze or whatever the thing is. And then suddenly you're like, oh, it's a yellow-breasted sparrow. Like,
yes.
That is literally my life. And now I'm like, right, I'm just going to take myself off and do some meditation and some breath work. So yeah, my weeks are very fitness focused in terms of looking after myself. I've really like found a passion for like things like reading and, you know, being able to actually spend time with myself without having to distract myself, which is one of my biggest challenges. I always needed that distraction. So definitely, you know, and I'm not saying I'm amazing at this stuff. It's a practice. And some days I'll pick up my book and I'll read the same sentence 10 times over. And I'm like, oh God, this is hard work. But I think the thing is, you just have to be comfortable with that and carry on. And then, yeah, like just work stuff is taking off at the moment. I've got my podcast. I've got the alcohol-free bar that I've recently launched. We're still a pop-up right now. So that means I'm kind of moving from space to space and doing events and comes with its own challenges. And then, yeah, I've been chatting a lot on podcasts recently and I absolutely love it.
You know what I love about your answer there, Carl? And it's... I've been trying to do this more consciously. I think it is definitely, I don't know if it's just a British thing or just a societal thing in general, but like when you meet someone at a party or whatever, the first question that everyone tends to go for is, oh, what do you do? Whereas what I've been trying to do more of is kind of, oh, what, you know, oh yeah, I'm Ben. Yeah, yeah. What floats your boat? You know, but your answer then, I said, oh, you're busy. And I think most people would go to professional life, work first, you know, but you spent a load of time telling us about all this amazing stuff that you do for yourself that you love. And then you went at the end, oh yeah, and work's quite good as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that.
I love that. I think that's so good. Go on. I am now going to contradict myself. Because I do want to know more about the pop-up bar. Like how, like where did the idea come from? Why did you think that there was a gap?
Yeah, yeah.
How's it been doing it? The man who said that, you know, you struggled with the basic tasks to kind of get yourself up and out.
Yeah. It's wild. It's wild. Now I'm like the other end of the spectrum. And I don't want to pretend that that all just comes with ease and like it's plain sailing, because it doesn't. And, you know, I had a massive freak out about something yesterday where my mind can go to the extremes of what am I doing with my life? I'm like, I'm cancelling everything. Like, I'm going to go, like, I get a lot of geographical type thinking, like, oh, I'm just going to move to India and do yoga and be on the beach all the time. But, you know, it's fine to notice those thoughts and then just carry on with your day. So, yeah, the alcohol-free bar, it's something that I've been thinking about for the last 12 months. And it was, I was in a bit of a tricky place with my job. So my background is very corporate. And I think when you get sober, you start to get more comfortable with making big decisions, because getting sober for me was the biggest decision of my life. You also start to live in a more values aligned way. I realized that the type of job I was doing in corporate capitalist environments for me wasn't serving me and wasn't fulfilling me. And if anything, was starting to have a negative effect on my mental health, or, you know, taking work home with me, taking situations home with me. And I just thought, what am I doing? But I had no idea what to do with my life. You know, when people say, oh, what do you want to do? I'm like, I don't know. I don't know what I want to be when I grow up. And then someone said to me, it was kind of serendipitous. So when I launched my podcast in January, I hosted a live event where we did like a live episode. And it was the venue owner who said to me, we was chatting about work and I was saying, I hate it and I want to get out of it. And she said, what was missing when you were at your rock bottom and what could have existed that maybe would have been helpful for you? And it made me think about, I'd already had this idea of an alcohol-free bar, but it kind of solidified that actually it's something that's missing. Now, don't get me wrong, when I was in my rock bottom, an alcohol-free bar wouldn't have helped me, because I would have told you to politely piss off if you'd invited me to an alcohol-free bar. What would the point of that have been? I was too far gone at that point. But I think there could have been opportunity for me to experience something different earlier in life if that type of thing had existed. And it's not necessarily about the space to just have an alcohol-free experience. It's the mindset and it's the kind of cultural norms around drinking that exist and the pressures of drinking in social environments and situations. It's something much bigger than that. And so, yeah, in July, I bit the bullet and I thought, right, every month I would say, no, I'll quit next month. I'll quit next month. I'll save a bit more money next month. And next month can last forever, right? It's like tomorrow. So I bit the bullet in July and I left my job and started to work on it full time. And honestly, it's been the best decision that I've ever made, other than getting sober. You know, sober underpins everything, but it's really taking off. It's the first alcohol-free bar in the North, and people are so interested in the concept, and not just conceptually, but people are showing up and buying drinks, and people are saying things like, oh God, we thought it'd be like a coffee shop or a library and a bit boring. And I'm like, no, that's exactly the point. That's what I'm trying to demonstrate. You know, we can put a nice drink in the glass and you can bring your mates and you can have a great night out and you don't have to be drinking alcohol. So yeah, it's going really well so far, to the point where I'm already looking for permanent space. And, you know, we've only been a pop-up for a couple of months. And what's really refreshing is it's really important to me that it's a safe space for sober people, whatever their experience. But what's also very refreshing is about half of my clientele are people that drink still, and people that wouldn't necessarily say they've got a problem with drink. They just want to do something different. And that to me is really important, because I think drinking is progressive, the impact that it has on you and the hold that it takes on you. And if I can help introduce people earlier on in their journey to something different, then that in the long term is going to have a much more positive impact, right? So yeah, it's great. I love it. I ain't got a clue what I'm doing. I've never run a bar in my life, but you know, we move.
Same with us at OTI. Do you know what? You just crack on, don't you? Just keep going.
Indeed. Indeed.
And it's a really important point you make about, you know, it's not just a bar for non-drinkers. You know, it's like there's some great stats. Do you remember, Shaz, the stats about, and Shaz loves my stats almost as much.
I love a quote. Statistic. Hit me.
Oh, but Carl.
I'll find the exact one for you, Carl, and I'll email it through. But it was about younger people dating, so young single people, and the percentage, I think it was something like 50% choosing not to drink for definitely the first date. And there's a lot of different reasons why. You know, alcohol can make us make decisions that we might not have made had we not had a few drinks. Also wanting to actually kind of connect with someone properly. You know, yeah, on that first date, is this something that I want to take forward or not? So you might get lots of, you know, all these young single things coming through on first dates. Carl, it could be your bar. They go, oh, do you remember on that first date we went to, and now we are?
Well, it's funny you say that, because in launch week, we had a couple come in on a date and they're now in a relationship. You know, this was a few months ago and they've basically not left each other's side since.
OMG.
Yeah, it's really, some of these stats, I'm going to hit you with some stats actually. So one in four 18 to 25 year olds do not drink alcohol at all. Like, that is mind blowing to me. When I take myself back to when I was between the ages of 18 and 25, there wasn't a single person around me in that same age bracket that wasn't drinking. Maybe that's because of the people I surrounded myself with. So yeah, generationally, the graph's going down. There was a survey that was conducted this year, and 61% of drinking age adults who responded to the survey said they drink rarely or sometimes, and 18% of people said they don't drink at all. So that means there's a bracket of over 75% of people, over three in four people, that really either don't drink or they very rarely drink. And so that is such a broad population to appeal to in terms of an alcohol-free bar and an alcohol-free way of living, or a more mindful way of living with alcohol, right? And then the last stat I'm going to give you, since the COVID-19 pandemic, there was some research done by the World Health Organization. And around 33% of drinking age adults have significantly reduced alcohol consumption. A health crisis has made everyone go, hang on a minute, I need to look after myself better because of everything that I've just seen. And, you know, if my health is not tip top, then I might be vulnerable. And this, you know, pandemics are not going away. So people have changed their drinking behavior because there's been a spotlight on health. I think the movement of alcohol-free is gaining so much momentum, and like veganism, when veganism started out, right, it was a dirty word, it was a swear word, and I think in 5 to 10 year times, the types of conversation that we're having right now will be so much more normalized, and the concept of alcohol-free will not be questioned in the way that it is today. You know, when people are like, oh, why don't you drink? Did you have a problem? Yeah. That type of thing.
And you know what? You would turn around, Carl, and go, well, actually, yeah, I did. And it took me to my rock bottom. And what? You know, where are you going to go with that? People don't have a right, do they? It saddens me massively that people do get questioned, you know, and berated and, you know, oh, just have one. I'm really interested to know who comes into your bar? Who comes to Love Sober? Who drinks in there?
Yeah, so it's a real mix of people that come into Love From. It's younger people. We get couples. We get a lot of couples where one of the people in the couple drinks and one of them doesn't. So it's really nice for people in relationships like that, because often the person who doesn't drink, I've heard so many people in that sort of situation say things like, oh God, yeah, I usually have to, when we go out, have to have like a Coke or a J2O basically. Whereas now, like, they feel like they're in the driving seat and they can say, oh, actually, we're going to go to Love From alcohol-free bar because I can have some really delicious drinks there. And also what I'm noticing, which is even more interesting, is when their partners who drink try one of my alternative drinks, they're like, I had it today, this guy with the old fashioned, he was like, that's 10 out of 10. I can't tell the difference. And so a lot of it is just giving people new experiences and education to the art of the possible. We have quite a broad, from a gender perspective, we have quite a broad female or female presenting audience. And that feels like quite typically aligned to what else I see in the sober space in terms of, you know, if I look at kind of sober influencers and on social media and all that type of thing, it tends to be more predominantly female. And that's reflected in my customer base in the bar as well.
You know what's really interesting though? So we talk about this all the time. And when you look at our podcast stats, because we've been doing this for three and a half years.
Wow.
For quite a long time now. So we've got
Feels like forever, a lot of data, Ben.
You know, and you know, we can tell age demographics, gender breakdowns for listeners of our podcast. So of all time listeners, because in terms of our community, it's definitely more female heavy than male heavy, isn't it, Chaz? Like in terms of the kind of the people that, I mean, definitely the blokes are, it's a lovely culture actually, you know, in terms of it's a very supportive space. It doesn't matter who you are, where you're from, what you believe, whatever, you know, but it's just really interesting because there's definitely still more women than men who are active parts of our community, but 60% of the people listening to this right now, according to our stats, 60% of our audience are male and 40% are female. And I wonder if that's because obviously a podcast, you put it in your ears, you go for your run. It's a very private thing, a podcast. 92% of people listen to podcasts on their own. Another stat for you there.
Oh, nice.
But I wonder if that's, 60% of our audience are men.
Yeah.
So 6 out of 10 people listening to this right now are fellas. But then they don't necessarily always step forward and say, and now I'd like to take the next step and I'd like to reach out. I'd like to connect. I'd like to go to an alcohol-free bar. I just find it always interests me.
That's so interesting. And
is it because, I don't know, is that classic thing still? Men don't talk about their feelings.
I think there's something in that. I think there's something in that. You know, we are making progress, right, with mental health conversations, but there's still something in getting the male population to feel more comfortable with being vulnerable, with talking about emotion. But then I think this is a step further than that, because there's being vulnerable and talking about emotion, but then the act of saying, hey, I'm putting my hand up here, I think I've got a problem with something, that is such a tricky thing to do. There was a survey that was done recently. I'm sorry this is going down such a statistic route.
Oh, it's absolutely
He's fabulous. This is, yeah, I love this kind of stuff.
It's so relevant. So this survey came out last week and they asked the survey respondents two questions. One was, do you think Britain has a drinking culture problem? 92% of people responded to say yes, right? So basically everyone's saying, yeah, there's a problem with drinking culture in Britain. Then they ask people, as an individual, do you have a problem with drinking? 10% of people said yes. So the gap there, the disconnect between what people are seeing and what people think, but their reflection on themselves, it's huge. And I think that comes down to the point that I'm trying to make, which is it's really hard to say, I've got a problem, this thing's not working. And bringing it back to the gender conversation and with male mental health and with being open and vulnerable, I think there's something in that. I think that's why.
This is one of the kind of fundamental reasons that Over the Influence exists. And it's taken us a while to kind of decide on our philosophy, hundreds of hours of conversation. But one of the things that I say is that I didn't have a drinking problem, in inverted commas, in traditional drinking problem, but drinking caused me problems. My drinking was becoming problematic, but I didn't have a physical dependence on alcohol. And I think that it's the shades of grey. And I think that's the big societal problem that we have. It's not black and white. It's not normal drinker, alcoholic drinker. Yeah. The shades of grey here. And for me, we talk about the scale, don't we, Shaz, of kind of hazardous. I want to get it right.
Harmful,
hazardous, dependent. You know, there's it's not black and white. It's not alcoholic, not alcoholic. It's not problem drinker, non-problem drinker. It's actually, are you damaging relationships? Because you go out on a night out and you say something that you thought was funny and actually you've really hurt someone's feet. is it harmful? Is it hazardous because you black out for 3 hours and you wake up the next day and you have a laugh about it? Oh yeah, I can't remember anything that happened after midnight. But actually you were a grown man walking around Birmingham city centre and not knowing what you're doing for 3 hours. I'd class that as hazardous. I think the conversation needs to change. And I love what you said earlier about how for you, using words like alcoholic and recovery help you, and that's the language that you like to use. You're giving power to that for you.
Yeah.
I think societally, I love that. I'm going to nick that, Carl, if that's all right, about the does Britain have a drinking problem, in inverted commas, do you? Because I think that is very, very interesting. But I think it's because if you asked the 90% of people who said no, if you ask them the question, but has drinking caused you problems?
Yeah.
I wonder how many people would come back and say, yeah.
That's so wise. That's so wise. It's a labelling thing.
Well, thanks, Carl.
Yeah, there you go. Props, Ben.
Can I jump in as well?
Go on.
I want to shove my two penneth in on that one, because I absolutely agree with everything Ben's just said there. But I also believe that until you step out of it, until you are not swimming in rosé every day like I was, and you look back, I would never have thought for one minute I had a drinking problem. Do you know what I mean? And obviously, evidently, I did. But until I stopped drinking, I wasn't able to look back and acknowledge that. And then it's like, oh my God. Oh my God, when did it get to this point? So there's so many people as well that I think don't actually realise, because as you said, it is progressive, it is insipid, and then for many women like me in the mid-40s, it bites you on the arse and you're like, when did that happen?
Yeah, it's so true. And in many ways, on that basis, that language then is just a deterrent, isn't it? Because people, it's almost like a self-defense mechanism that is like, okay, well, I'm not at this extreme end of the spectrum. You know, I'm not sat on the roadside with a bottle of whiskey, so I'm not dependent or an alcoholic. But because it's progressive and insipid and it happens like slowly in the way that it does, you just don't notice those things. And who's to say what's problematic for me versus problematic for you, right? It's the impact that it has on your life and on your health. And, it, you know, if there's something there that's not working, then it probably is a problem.
Carl, I knew this episode would be phenomenal. I knew love you. And I know we could talk again. I wish we could do another 3 hours. We've got to wrap up.
No, I've had such a good time. Thank you.
It's flown.
Come back, Carl.
You will come back. I would love you to come back. I've got one final question, and I hope you don't mind me asking this before you go. What would little Carl think of what big Carl is doing now?
Oh, God, don't set me off. I think little Carl would... I think little Carl would be... It would almost be like... Well, yeah, of course that's what you're doing, because you've always had that potential and you're just fulfilling what you've always been capable of. I don't think it would have been a surprise or a shock, because what alcohol did for me and does for a lot of people is strips back your potential. And so I think little Carl would be feeling relieved and... supportive of that.
Carl Considine, you are one of the nicest humans we've ever had the pleasure of speaking to. That's made me really emotional.
I feel emotional. I'm going to go eat some chocolate now.
Have some chocolate and a brew. Carl, very quickly, because we are out of time, if people want more information about Love From, about the alcohol-free bar, and about your podcast as well and what you do, where can they find all that? Give it a good plug.
They can find me on Insta. Love From is... at love.fromco, and the podcast What Next is at whatnext.podcast.
Carl, thank you.
Thanks so much. Have a great Christmas.